You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
I wanted the fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone in public, excuse me. So wanting my cake and eat it too. Wanting it both ways, fame, maybe a
very good Tuesday morning to you. So the other night, I have like a lot of hate in me right now. I'm not going to lie to you. And I don't know, those of you that live with hate, it's like a drug. I call it my black blood. When it starts going, it's like being, for me anyway, it's like being high. It's like a hyper state of living. Like I'm sitting here talking, my toe is tapping at the cyclic rate. Two things have me pissed this morning. Let me get my crystal ball and tell you what's going to happen out of that shit in Minneapolis. Now, I should be much more measured in my comments, but... And I'm going to pile on to the whole healthcare thing. The continuing gong show that emanates from the nation's capital. Good morning, by the way. Let me tell you what's going to happen. Okay, so let me paint a picture of you of events in and around Minneapolis. Sunday night, a woman hears a sexual assault. She's Australian. She's 40 years old. She's one of the hummingbird people, right? Holistic healer, blah, 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 living in Minneapolis. Here's what she believes to be a sexual assault going on behind her house in an alley. So she calls police. Police show up. She goes out with her cell phone to talk to them. She's at either crouched down or standing out in her pajamas on the passenger side door. No, on the driver's side door. A police officer who I think has been on the Minneapolis police force for about a year is driving the vehicle. Another police officer, Somali-born, is in the passenger seat. He reaches across and shoots her in the abdomen, and she dies of her wound. Okay. So one of two things. Either there was some kind of accidental discharge that happened, or... Or he saw this American woman, she's Australian, in her pajamas, and he's a Muslim. It didn't jive with his culture, and he murdered her. Now, that happened Sunday night. We're now at Tuesday, and normally, within 24 hours of an accident, you would have the chief of police and the mayor going on camera to tell the community what's happened. Yesterday, no statement by the Minneapolis Police Department. The mayor said she can't say anything because she's helpless, because there has to be an outside investigation of this. To which I respond, bullshit. You're the mayor. You're the leader of that fucking city. Act like it. And I'll tell you what, if it was an accident, she would have the police chief with her and she would make a statement. As he attempted to get out of the car, he unholstered his weapon, and it discharged. It's a terrible accident. I want to assure the people we're going to review our procedures. Blah, 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 fucking blah. Okay, so if that didn't happen yesterday, then what the fuck happened? So I don't want to sound the Islamic alarm too fast. All I'm saying is that my black blood hears that stuff and it reacts to it. If that's true, there's going to be a lot of pissed off people in this country. So anyway, so that's got me pissed today. Next thing is healthcare. We are going to repeal and replace and blah, 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 fucking blah. Oh, it's a little bit harder than that. Is it? Menses? I mean, what a bunch of assholes, honestly. I think they should be locked in the Capitol and get told, fix it, repeal it, replace it, fix it, don't come out till you're done. No 3-week vacation, none of that, no bullshit, blah, 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 blah. And again, in its own way, I think Rand Paul's right. Repeal it. Have the votes repeal it. People like him will support that. He can go back and defend that to his constituents. And then the replace, Republicans can work with Democrats to create something new. When you're not trying to do it in one fell swoop. And those will be the people that will hop on board for the spending bill. And he can oppose that too if he wants. And they can all defend that back in their own states and their own districts, because that's where it all lies. So Rand Paul, his solution, there's a bit of genius to it in that. It's where they live, right? It's where they live. He can defend that. He can defend both those votes. I told you I was going to replace it, repeal it, and I did that. I couldn't sign up for the replace, and I've opposed it. I tried to shape it, but they've enacted another piece of garbage, and I'm fighting against that. So, blah, 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 blah. So at some point, don't you have to govern? At some point, don't you have to do something? What is Congress for? And I'll tell you what, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, all this bullshit, get them all out of there. Just get a fire hose and rinse it out. I'm so sick of them. I'm sick of Paul Ryan, too. Shut up, man. You get paid for output, not bloviating press conferences and all the rest of the nonsense you jackasses do. Get something done. Push the ball down the road. It's just stupid. So anyway, so I had a conversation with a Vietnam veteran the other night, and he asked me if I knew anything about My Lai, and I said no. And so then I have these moments in my life where I think of, like, how can you not know anything about that event? I was like, I didn't. This started a few years ago when I was doing a project with my daughter Colleen. She's doing a living museum, and she said, should I be Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks? I said, come on, man, Martin Luther King. And so she was Martin Luther King. I said, you'll learn more. He's an incredible figure in our history. So as Colleen and I are doing research, I realize I don't know anything about Martin Luther King. I mean, I know notionally what I, you know, the things I've read about him, things I know about him, things I've seen on TV about him, but I haven't really read about him. So I read about him. Holy smokes. Pretty incredible. Well, I've had the same experience with like Lincoln. I had never read a definitive biography about Lincoln, so doing that. And so when this guy asked me about Melania, I was like, no, I really haven't. So yesterday, after I got off the air, I started, you know, I have other work to do. You have to cut up audio, blah, blah, blah. You have to do all this, you know, post to the website. You have to push it out on Twitter, yada, yada, yada. So I start watching stuff about Melania. And so that's what you and I are going to do today together. We're going to listen to Melai. And if you don't know anything about it, just take the next couple hours and just stop what you're doing, because your vacuum tubes are going to get blown. It is absolutely, positively the craziest shit you've ever heard. It's astounding. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to give you kind of an overview, and you're going to hear from David Hackworth, retired United States Army colonel, the most decorated soldier of his era, joined the Army after World War II, fought in Korea, fought in Vietnam, wrote the book About Face. And so Hackworth gets interviewed with a guy named Randy Roberts, and they talk about Melania. I think they wrote something together about it. Anyway, so you'll hear from him, it's kind of an overview, which is astounding. So my going in assumption was that these guys, Charlie Company, I want to say the 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry, the AmeriCal Division, they had been chewed up, and the answer is no. They hadn't hardly fought. They had dealt with snipers. They had dealt with, mines and stuff like that. They hadn't fought. And what they get told is, going into Melai, the way they get prepared is incredible. This captain, by the name, you know, Captain Medina, right, Lieutenant Callie, Callie's a turd. Listen, you'll hear David Hackworth say he gets blown out of Army OCS three different times for leadership. This Captain Medina, the night before when he briefs everybody, he tells him to kill everybody. And they're like, well, women and anybody who's there is DC or VC sympathizer. Kill everything, dogs, cats, water, you know, all of it. So, and you'll hear, and so what we'll do is you'll hear Hackworth, and then you'll hear probably a little bit more detail of the case. And then I don't know if we'll get to it today. It might continue till tomorrow. But you'll hear those guys in their own words, and you'll hear them. There's a couple different sets of interviews. One is relatively soon after the event. And you'll hear these guys talking about it. And then another one is years later. And one of the reasons I want to do this is the mental health piece in all of this. And the significance of keep your honor clean. Boys, you are living with this forever. You know, and that line of Maximus is in Gladiator. I need to record it. You know, what we do in life echoes in eternity. No shit, motherfucker. And when you hear these guys trying to deal with it. Some of them believe, no, I did the right thing. We're soldiers. That's what we do. We were given an order. We executed it. And it's not my, I don't bear any responsibility. And they maintain that. And to me, when I hear that, that is a guy convincing himself that what he did was right. And he's terrified that if he opens that thing a quarter of an inch to consider that murdering children, babies for God's sakes, women, old people, yeah, that they somehow got it in their head that was some kind of military mission. Imagine that. And then you'll hear in part of the story is the helicopter pilot who lands between these, who doesn't understand what's going on because he knows they're not taking any incoming. They're not calling in any medevacs, but he's seeing all these bodies and he's flying around in one of those small Kiowa with two door gunners on it. And, he's zooming around looking like, what's going on? What's going on? And so he finally figures it out, and he's like, he's rip shit about it. And if you can imagine this, I was watching this last night, him in a panel, and later, he was then, after this happens, he's ostracized. He walks in the chow hall, everybody walks out. That's what happens to this guy. But he sets the helicopter down between the guys doing the shooting and people hiding in a bunker, about a dozen people. He gets out, and I think he talks to Callie, although I'm not sure. And he comes back to the helicopter, and he said he's furious, and he looks at one of his door gunners. There's two of them. One gets killed not too long thereafter. And he looks at him, and he says, I'm going to go get those people out of the bunker. If those soldiers start shooting, open up on them. And so on this panel are he and one of the door gunners that survived. And somebody asked the door gunner, how old were you when this happened? He said, I was 18. Can you imagine receiving that order? If those guys shoot at me, kill them. And he walks over to his bunker and he gets these people out, brings them near the helicopter, radios to a buddy of his in a gunship, a Huey gunship. I need a favor. You've got to come in and get these people out of here. And this Huey gunship, he said, we never did this. We never transported civilians, for God's sakes. But he said he needed my help. So I did it. I came in, we loaded these people on, and we got out of there. They killed over 500 people that day. Not a VC in the lot. No military age males there. Herding them into ditches and machine gunning them. But what I want you to hear, and this goes to the whole thing about leadership at the point of confrontation. This is not hard, this one. And you're going to hear Hackworth call, talk about what a piece of shit Callie was. Medina used to refer to him as his piece of shit. Yeah. And so, how do these things happen? How does something like that happen? How does nobody, except this helicopter pilot, say, what are you doing? We don't do this. You'll hear Hackworth kind of in an overview piece. And then, you'll hear these young soldiers talk when they're younger, and then you'll hear many of them talk when they're older. And what they've lived with their entire life and how their lives have been, forever linked to this, how they can't get away from it, how they constantly dream about it. And so what do they suffer from? Post-traumatic stress. But it's the worst post-traumatic stress that you can have. It isn't simply that I went there and there were things that happened, that were unpleasant, but my honor is clean. So I live with it. I live with the horror of war. What it is the worst of the worst. It's not only do I live with the horror of war, I live with my stained honor, knowing that I failed in my responsibility to my fellow soldiers, to the nation, and to these people that I murdered. The burden does not get any heavier. And there's no place to run from it. Because every night when you're alone, it visits you. So, with all that said, that little intro, stand by. You're going to hear from David Hackworth here in a matter of minutes. United States Marine Corps Band. And let me tell you, it's fascinating. The investigation, and Callie doesn't, he doesn't serve shit. He gets convicted, sentenced to life in prison. The only person convicted in it. The Army covered the whole goddamn thing up. The only reason it comes to light, and you'll hear this, is they redeploy to Hawaii. Okay? They redeploy to Hawaii, and there's two guys are drinking, and he said, "Hey man, did you hear about what we did in Pinkville?" Other guy, I think his name's Rittenauer or something like that, who starts the whole thing. He says, "No, what'd you do?" He said, "We smoked the whole village." Rittenauer was like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, we smoked everybody, like 500 people." Like, what, D.C.? Or like, no, they're civilian. So he starts doing research, and he collects all this information, and then he writes the Secretary of the Army, Secretary of Defense, a whole bunch of congressmen, and he mails this thing out. And then the Cleveland Plain Dealer gets pictures from an Army photographer that was there that day. He had two cameras. He had his Army photographer, and when you see in the investigation, when you see the pictures of what the official Army photographs of the op are, typical stuff, right? Guy in deuce gear, in his jungle boots, you know, poking his rifle into a hut, another soldier, you know, with his Zippo lighter, lighting a hut on fire, you know, soldiers talking to kids, blah, blah, blah. With his own personal camera, it's a color camera, that's where the pictures of Milai come from. From that camera. And they're published, for the first time in a Cleveland Plain Dealer. And those things hit the country, you know, with a thud that you can still feel today. And then Life Magazine, gets all the pictures and they publish them. Yeah. For those of you old enough to remember, Life Magazine, I don't know what it would be. I don't know, there is no equivalent. Life Magazine was the magazine. And I'll never forget as a kid when they started publishing the photo of every person killed in Vietnam. Their picture. And it was page after page after page. Amazing. So anyway, that's what we're doing today. Sit back, and let me just tell you, it'll be jaw-dropping. And the other night I just had a conversation, and then I started listening yesterday, I couldn't stop. How can Americans do this? You're going to hear how it happened. We'll be right back.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I didn't even mention the raping, did I? And so what I want to do with this is I want to talk about this today. I want you to hear audio today and maybe tomorrow, depending on how much we get through. But you need to hear it. It's incredible. And then I want to bring, you know, Marines who were in Vietnam. And, you know, and Hackworth will mention the Army in Vietnam. Beads, smoking dope. And you'll hear hear these soldiers talking about raping women as they move through villages. I mean, it's you hear it, and you're like, you know. So how do you lose your soul? And really, one of the things. I mean, I'm even reluctant to describe it, right? And it's a statement from a Vietnamese woman who. I saw yesterday who it's being translated. She watches her sister be raped. Soldier gets off her, shoots her and kills her, and then sticks his knife in her vagina and rips the knife out. It's like, and again, the thing that's mind-blowing about this, it's not like these guys were fighting, like the fighting that you've heard Carl Marlanis describe. These guys were not a part of that. They were patrolling, had gone into to booby traps, had got sniped, they had lost guys. But it's not like they were in prolonged combat. And yeah, I get it, you're frustrated. But so you're going to hear what happens when frustration, draftees and bad leadership all get together in one spot. And at Me Live, you're going to find out how it works out. You'll hear that next. Don't touch, promise me, don't touch your dial. If you don't know anything about Me Live, it's absolutely stunning to hear it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right. David Hackworth, if you don't know him, the most decorated soldier of his era. Korea, Vietnam, wrote the book About Faced. He came to speak at the basic school when I was an officer there and was incredibly excited about what was going on in the Marine Corps, what he called the intellectual renaissance of the United States military. And he, in fact, went all over the Army telling the Army they could better get their shit together and what they ought to do is they ought to get their asses to Quantico and find out what the Marine Corps was doing. And we got visited by the guys from Fort Benning, and he was a huge fan of the intellectual awakening in the Marine Corps, and had very pointed things to say about thinking and fighting and things like that, and being a professional. So he's an interesting guy. But you're going to hear him in this audio in an interview talking about My Lai, and as I told you before, absolutely incredible stuff.
The sharpest enemy we'd encountered since we fought the Native...
This is Hackworth's voice right there.
Americans a long time before.
This was a very different war than any previous war. Is that right, Professor Roberts?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that. In some ways, there were some continuities, but one difference was that the civilians oftentimes had become part of the war in a way that they weren't certainly before World War II. Another difference is the whole concept of body counts, I think. How do you measure progress in a war? One of the things we could have done is tried to take Hanoi, turned it into a land war with an objective that we could achieve. But I think there was fear, whether it was justifiable or not, that the Chinese would have intervened. So how do we measure progress? And we determined that we can measure progress through body counts. Mm-hmm. And how do you count the enemy's dead?
Yeah, in the documentary, one of the soldiers says that during the war he lost his humanness. What did he mean by that?
Well, war is a very brutal thing, and it's unless a unit is well disciplined and has really great leadership, it's very easy to end up as a butcher. And I think that in a lot of cases, as the war progressed and the frustration increased, that attitude in many units that didn't have the kind of discipline that was needed, that prevailed.
And we're leading up to My Lai. We had the Tet Offensive in 1960. What was the Tet Offensive, and how does that play into the whole My Lai incident?
Oh, I think the Tet Offensive is important. It comes at the end of January of 1968. My Lai, of course, is in March 16th, 1968. The Tet Offensive was a major offensive by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese to overrun the South. It fails. The Army, the United States Army, overcomes the Tet Offensive. And now I think they saw their chance at some payback and mopping up. The My Lai takes place when the army in Pinkville of Quanggai Province, which is a particularly hot zone, they're going after the 48th Battalion, which was
a Charlie Company.
Charlie Company, and more than Charlie Company, the Barker, Task Force Barker. And the 48th was a wily enemy who had been crippled somewhat by Tent, but they still knew what they were doing. They had, as a colonel can tell you, they had been around for a long time.
Yeah.
They had fought the French.
Mm-hmm.
They knew what they were doing.
And who were some of the leaders of Charlie Company? Who were some of the people who are involved in...
Well, Medina was the company commander, and of course, Cali was a platoon leader. And one of my arguments with the whole exercise is that with bad leadership, you get bad results. Cali would not have been a private in any other army, but he ended up as a lieutenant who had gone through OCS three times and failed on the most important aspect of being an infantry leader, which is leadership. And he was still passed because the army was not into quality. They were into low attrition and quantity. So we ended up producing a number of Calis, and we didn't have the kind of leadership down at the bottom that was needed, nor did we have leadership at the mid-level, the Bartley level,
mm-hmm.
or did we have it at the top, at the division level. What we had was leaders that were supervising their units by being squad leaders in the sky, drilling holes in the sky in helicopters and looking down and not being in touch with the bottom. And the bottom didn't have the kind of leadership and cohesion that they needed to prevent a massacre like that happening.
Okay. So what exactly is the mission of Charlie Company as they enter My Lai? What were Cali's orders as he enters My Lai?
The expectation was, is the remnants of the 48th Viet Cong Division was going to be at My Lai. When the soldiers go into My Lai, they expect action. They were told that the women, the children, would be away. It was a market day. They expected to have a fight. You know, they did not go into My Lai expecting to encounter a civilian population.
Okay, let's take a break here. Coming up, a step-by-step account of the massacre at My Lai. Back in a moment. Welcome back to As It Happened. We're talking about the 1968 massacre at My Lai with Professor Randy Roberts, author of My Lai, A Brief History with Documents, and David Hackworth, retired U.S. Army colonel and author of About Face, The Odyssey of an American Warrior. Professor Roberts, we left off with Charlie Company is pursuing the 48th Battalion. Lieutenant Cali heads the one of the platoons in Charlie Company, and they are moving into My Lai. Now, what happens once they get into My Lai?
Well, they land at about slightly before 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's tall elephant grass, perfect for snipers, and the men are tensed up. They're psyched. They think there's going to be action. They see somebody running, maybe a Viet Cong, maybe a farmer, who knows? He's pretty much blasted away in the first moment. And nothing happens. They move in. They find the enemy that was supposed to be there simply isn't there.
And who is there?
Who's there are women and children, very young children, old men, no draft age men, which obviously was a haven for the Viet Cong. And so they start to move through the village. There's individual acts of violence as they move through the village.
Okay, now does Calley report this information back to his commander, Medina? What is Medina's response?
Medina's response first is get through the village. You're moving too slow. Callie's response is well, we're collecting a lot of prisoners as we go. We're rounding up the women, the children, the old men into packs, and that's taking time.
Okay, now Calley says later that Medina told him to waste the town.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, if we can go back even to the night before when they're given their briefing, Medina says, go into the town, basically, and waste it. Or at least this is what some of the people remember. You know, kill everything, burn the huts, burn the hooches, kill the water buffalo, kill the ducks, kill the chickens, kill everything, move through, destroy, sanitize the village.
Colonel, you were in Vietnam. Is it uncommon for someone to get a command to waste a village? What does that mean?
Well, I think this was born from the frustration of the kind of war that was being fought. It was a war that the casualties for infantry were incredible, and they were mainly brought about in this particular area of operations from mines and booby traps. Your enemy was in the shadow, and the soldier going through that kind of stuff didn't know from moment to moment whether he was going to have a foot, a leg, or a life. And then you get into a fight, and the idea is all of that frustration comes roaring out. And the people, if they're not a disciplined organization, they just lose the military values that they should have, and they just become unglued. And I think that mob hysteria is what occurred there. I've seen that happen a few times on an objective where infantry had finally gotten to the top of the objective, and wounded enemy soldiers are just blown away. And that's the most dangerous time in combat, is when the two forces come together. It's a bloodbath, and you're smelling the blood. You're in the middle of the slaughter yard. And I think that insanity is what prevailed there.
So Calley gets these orders to waste the village. His troops are scared. They've been expecting enemy. They're frustrated by the war. What does Calley do? What exactly does Calley do?
First of all, maybe the enemy's there. Nobody, you have to realize this village, nobody sees everything going on. It's hard to see what's happening 20 or 30 yards to your right or your left. All you hear is gunfire. Is it enemy gunfire? Is it our own gunfire? You're not really sure. But we have groups of civilians that were gathered together. And Calley goes to the people guarding the group and he says, kill them, you know, shoot them, get rid of them. And he himself participates in the worst, the most horrific episodes of the killing.
If I can jump in there,
sure.
Is it, if it were a disciplined organization, and remember, we went to Vietnam in 1965 with the finest Marines, the finest Army that we've ever had in the history of those two forces. But by this time in the war, 3 years later, we've lost our NCOs, we've lost our officers, so we're there with a second team. We're with shake-and-bake NCOs like Calley that should have never been a leader. With bad leadership up at the top. And you put all of that together, and you've got the ingredients for trouble. In a good, regular, disciplined unit, for example, in the Korean War, as a platoon leader, I had taken six Chinese prisoners, and my company commander said, waste them. I said, go screw yourself. I'm not wasting anybody. If you want to do it, come down and do it. But I'm not going to do it, because I well knew what the Geneva Convention said, and I was a trained soldier. But when you have a mob, and that's what we had by 1968, that there was just ended drugs and disorganization and hatred for the war and no support at home for the war. And if a country doesn't support the war effort, you've lost it.
And I think we should also remember is that not everybody participated in the slaughter.
Were there any heroes in this?
Oh, absolutely there were heroes. There was a helicopter pilot, Thompson, who lands his helicopter and positions himself between civilians and his own army and directs the gun on his own forces, and he evacuates, or he calls for the evacuation of some people who would have been killed.
Thompson, he landed his chopper right between the American fire going into the Vietnamese ranks. And that stopped the fire. And ironically, on March the 6th, he is going to be awarded the Soldier Medal for saving lives all of these years later.
Why did it take so long?
The American Army wanted to forget that massacre, that terrible stain on its record. And the American Army buried Vietnam. They wanted to get back to the fold of Gap and Desert Storm and tanks in action and all of that. And as a result of that, refusing to recognize what happened in Vietnam, that gave birth to Somalia and the terrible disaster that occurred there.
So we have in My Lai then is really pure chaos, a breakdown of leadership, just random killing of innocent people. Not always random.
It was a breakdown in leadership, to be sure. There was no leadership. But Cowley's were cold-blooded executions. I mean, he wasn't going berserk when he was doing these things. He, I think, was trying to, he knew that no one had respect for him. And he had respect for Medina. And I think in his own mind, he thought he was going to be looking better for Medina. And so what he did with a cold calculation that was frightening.
Tell me about Lieutenant Cowley. What type of character is he?
Medina referred to him as Lieutenant Shithead. Some people have said that he had almost too much ordinariness to be burdened with. He's a person who never learned to read a map. His men had absolutely no respect
for
him.
How did he end up in a position of leadership?
The system. And ironically enough, at that time, just before the Cowley incident, I was in Department of the Army, the Pentagon, in the training. I ran the OCS and the Ranger School and all of that. And back in the 50s, if 40% of a class graduated, meaning 100 people started and 40 graduated, that was great. You turned out 40 good leaders. Then we were trying to graduate 100%. So we kept graduating the Cowleys that should have not been even in uniform, let alone leading forces. And the men didn't have confidence in him. And as a result, you had the chaos that battle bore.
Okay, we'll take a break now. The massacre at My Lai may have gone unrecorded had it not been for a letter sent to political and military leaders 1 year later. Coming up next, the public learns the truth about My Lai. Back in a moment. We're taking a look at the 1968 My Lai massacre with Professor Randy Roberts and retired U.S. Army Colonel David Hackworth. Professor Roberts, we left off. This atrocity takes place in My Lai in March of 1968. But it's almost a year later before anyone learns about this. The Army conducts a brief inquiry, which is essentially a whitewash. If it wasn't for a letter written by one of the soldiers, we probably never would have known about My Lai. Can you tell us a little bit about the soldier in the letter?
Yeah, that's right, Riedenauer. He was not involved in My Lai, but he had trained in Hawaii with some of the people in Charlie Company who had. And he, a few months after My Lai, he was having a conversation with one in a bar, and over a beer said, "Did you hear what happened at Pinkville?" Pinkville was the designate for the My Lai area. And Riedenauer said, "No, what?" He said, "Oh, it was a massacre. We massacred a village." And Riedenauer said he felt almost an epiphany at that moment that suddenly he had been sucked into the vortex of this thing, and he was either going to be complicit in the crime or he was going to get to the bottom of it. And so he started to investigate. He started to talk to other people. He read the reports on what supposedly happened at My Lai. He even met one person, Michael Bernhardt, who was at My Lai but had not participated in the killings. And Bernhardt told him that when he got back to the States that he planned to assassinate everybody up the chain of command, starting with Cowley and Medina. He was so shaken. And he was a person who had gone through military school and felt very strongly about the institution and how the institution had been sullied.
Colonels, you probably heard rumors all the time about atrocities. How do you decide which ones to believe and which ones not to believe?
Well, I was in Vietnam at the time, down in the Delta with this army that had just fallen apart. Love beads, dope, the whole work. And rumors kept coming, and they were coming from helicopter community. Mm-hmm. You'd get into a bird, and you'd hear what happened up north. And so I got this story and kind of put it together. I didn't believe it. And I remember defending the American soldier, saying, "This is not in his character. He is not capable of acting as the Nazis did during the Bastogne campaign of killing American prisoners. We just don't have soldiers like this." And then when it came out, when all of the evidence was sufficient and there was a commission and so on, it just tore the heart out of the Army. Down at the bottom, among the grunts, they didn't want to be there in the first place. But among the regulars, the ones that brought honor and made up the Army, it just was a real tough hit in the gut.
Let's go back. How did it come out? How did this letter come out?
Riedenauer is discharged. He goes home. He asks friends, confidants, what should I do? They tell him to forget it. He can't forget it. Finally, he writes a letter, about a five-page letter. He sends it to Udall. He's in Arizona, who was his senator. Yes. And he sends it to the President of the United States, Secretary of Army, a number of senators and congressmen. And he says, here is what I've learned. Here are the people I talked with. Something needs to be done. If we are a country, we need a conscience. And this has to be investigated. And slowly an investigation starts. And once it gets in the hands of peers, it absolutely takes off. And the peers commission looks into the entire affair. Eventually, all the top people will be charged with war crimes.
What about Seymour Hersh, who won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting me lying? Weren't there also photographs in Life magazine?
Riedenauer was afraid that when he saw Callie charged, he thought it was going to stop with Callie. And this incensed him. He was mad about this because it wasn't just Callie. And so then all of a sudden, Seymour Hersh is sort of nosing around, and he hears about this letter, and he interviews Riedenauer, and Riedenauer tells him everything he knows and gives him a lot of other names. And this prompts a number of his investigations and a number of articles that he writes. At the same time, you have a person named Heberle, who was a photographer, the official Army photographer. He had an official Army camera, black and white film, which the Army had. He had his own private camera, color film, which he kept. He took pictures of the atrocities with his film, not with the Army film, because the Army wouldn't want those pictures. And then these pictures will be published first in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, or some of them, and then in a big expose in Life magazine.
I think it had not been for the character of General Pierce, had he been any other general of that time that Westmoreland who would have picked to cover the whole thing up, then we would have never been able to have the cleansing that the My Lai thing ended up in. We'd have never been able to really look into it and find out exactly what went down, except for the uniqueness of Pierce, who was one of our most incredible warriors that we had at that rank. He was really a soldier.
Well, he did an absolutely fantastic job. And Pierce's report runs to 100 or so volumes. He interviewed everybody. It is a painstaking, almost second-by-second report. And he, when it comes to culpability and who did what, he doesn't shrink from naming names.
And there's a military trial.
And that, yes.
And who's put on trial, and what's the verdict?
A number of people, several scores of people, are put on trial. Some, for example, General Coster is accused. He never goes to trial, although at that time he was commandant at West Point, and he is reduced in rank, and it ruins, as you were saying, a
great
career.
He was the guy that was going to go to 4 stars. Was Colin Powell tried?
No, Colin Powell wasn't tried. But Colin Powell
had his involvement.
Colin Powell had been involved in the initial cover-up. Supposedly an investigation was done. It wasn't done, and he had signed off on it. And so it's
and
unique.
The young major. Had his fingerprints all over it.
How about Medina, Callie's officer, who Callie said gave him the order to waste the village? Was he tried? And was
Yes, but he was not convicted. The only person convicted was Callie.
Why is that?
Well, some evidence was lost. Some people who had good memories a year before suddenly had weaker memories. The vagaries of the judicial system.
Does he become a scapegoat? Is Callie a scapegoat for what?
Absolutely not. The guy's a murderer.
Yeah.
Full stop. And boy, he got off lucky. Richard Nixon let him walk, but he shouldn't have. He should have been lined up against the wall.
Well, let's
and
back
shot.
Up. To, he's convicted in this trial, but what happens between the time he's tried and convicted, and what happens later with Richard Nixon?
Well, Nixon, he's convicted. Of course, it goes to appeal.
And it's a lifetime sentence?
A life sentence, hard labor. During the appeal, Nixon allows him, he doesn't have to go to a military prison. He's given base privileges.
With his girlfriend visiting
him. With
his
girlfriend visiting him, yes. Eventually, he goes and he serves about 4 months in Fort Leavenworth. and then the Secretary of the Army actually commutes the sentence and he's left out. So he serves very little time. Was he a scapegoat? No. He was guilty of everything he's charged. Should other people have received penalties other than slaps on the wrist? I think it's probably safe to say yes.
So what exactly did Richard Nixon do to affect Calley's release?
Richard Nixon does really two things. The first thing he does is allow Calley out during the appeal process after Calley is convicted, which takes a period of time, a year and a half or so. Then Richard Nixon becomes involved in his own troubles just at about the time that Calley's appeal fails. Calley goes to prison about Fort Leavenworth. About 4 months later, he's left out by the Secretary of the Army, ending the case.
Summing this up, why did My Lai take place? Was this a product of the unique circumstances of the Vietnam War, or is this primarily due to the lack of effective leadership of people like
Calley? An axiom of war, it's one of the most important aspects, is to know your enemy. And we didn't know our enemy. Now, Secretary of Defense McNamara at that time recently, last year, spent a number of months in North Vietnam trying to put the war back together. He came away from this long conference where he studied with his counterpart, his North Vietnamese counterpart. He came away saying, the thing about the war was we didn't understand our enemy. And that's it. And I think what it is, it's good old Yankee arrogance. That we didn't understand our enemy, we didn't know how to fight that war, we refought it as World War II, we bloodied our army early in the game, we didn't have the hardcore junior leaders, and because of the invent of the helicopter, we had all these squad leaders in the sky flying around, totally out of touch of what was going on at the bottom. And then the point that you brought up, the need for body count, that was the objective. There wasn't a Berlin, there wasn't a Rome, there wasn't a Tokyo, there wasn't a terrain objective. There was this false body count that absolutely destroyed the honor of the system. It would be like you saying, okay, kids, grade yourself. They all get A's.
So is My Lai the logical outgrowth of a failed military strategy?
I would say yes. I would say that one of the great scars that we'll carry away from Vietnam, and not taking away anything that those magnificent men that carried that black rifle in that terrible battlefield did there. They were real heroes. But we'll all go to our grave, those veterans of Vietnam, with that smear on us.
That's well said. Professor Roberts, do you have any concluding comments?
Well, I would say we didn't know our enemy, and I'm not sure we knew ourselves. I don't think we knew really what we did best. And we were playing it by cuff. We weren't training our troops like they should have been trained. We weren't providing the leaders that they deserved at the tail end of the war. And we just simply didn't know how to do it right. For a moment in history, a fragment of time, we lost direction, I think. And My Lai, I hope it wasn't the inevitable result of losing direction, but it was a tragic result of losing direction.
It seems that a lot of forces came together, conspired to create My Lai. It was the nature of guerrilla warfare, where it was difficult for American soldiers to distinguish between civilians and soldiers. It was the failed political strategy in Vietnam. And finally, it was the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time, people like Lieutenant Calley. So thank you for helping us to understand this better.
The sharpest enemy.
You know, that last part is bullshit, okay? And what you're going to hear now is in the next audio, you'll start to hear the voices of the guys that were there. And you're going to hear them tell their story. And it blows your vacuum tubes. This wasn't hard, okay? This wasn't hard to tell the difference between who was friend and who was foe, okay? These people are like every people that are caught in the crossfire of a war, from the Helmand province to Al Anbar to Somalia, right? the Americans are here now, the Viet Cong come at night, and I'm just a farmer, for God's sakes, trying to raise my kids and eke out a living and support my mom and dad, and, you know, you got to be kidding me, right? Caught in the middle. And we don't understand it. And so, but when you hear the story and you see the pictures, it's not like it's hard. That's not a combatant. That grandma, that 70-year-old woman, she's not a combatant. That 3-month-old baby, he's not a combatant. So you'll hear from them after this, as we look at My Lai. And again, why study this? This whole notion of leadership at the point of confrontation, why it's important for you to act, why it's important for you to keep your honor clean. We have to be able to provide, you know, the reasons why. Not just because it's the right thing to do. And you'll hear these guys. Again, what you're saving him from is an eternity of hell. So you got to be strong. You got to do the right thing. You can't be afraid. And so, to me, I love the discussion of leadership. This is something I don't know a whole lot about, but I'm learning. I will post on the website under show notes the link to the investigation, the Pierce Report. And it is voluminous. But I will tell you what, it's very, very interesting reading. All the attachments, all the maps that go with My Lai. I mean, if you do a search of on Google Earth for My Lai, it takes you to the wrong place. If you look at the photographs of the time, and if you go to the Wikipedia page and you take the Lat Long off the Wikipedia page, it'll take you to the correct village. But it's hard to find the right spot. It still looks exactly the same. There's a few new roads in the region, in the area right around the village, but essentially the same exact shaped village defined by the shape of the roads that surround it. Very easy to spot. So we'll take a quick break. Part two of our look at My Lai, an American massacre of Vietnamese civilians, one that wasn't hard to spot, one that wasn't hard to walk away from. You just had to have a leader there. And obviously, as you just heard, the only leader happened to be, I mean, there was individual soldiers who said, I won't do it. And you're going to hear what they thought about disobeying an order in combat, right, that they could be executed for. You're going to hear them talk about it. And pretty interesting stuff. Pretty interesting stuff. More of All Marine Radio on a Tuesday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world famous Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. battlemug.com.